Today on Soundtrack Alley, I'll be delving into a film and score that not many really want to discuss, but I like it for its score and the brilliance of the unique sci-fi aspects of the world and how many similarities there are between the world of the video games and the world of the film. The film I'm discussing is Final Fantasy: The Spirits Within. The score is by Elliot Goldenthal. So sit back and relax as the show starts now. Hello, I am your host, Randy Andrews. Today, I'm discussing Final Fantasy: The Spirits Within. No, this isn't a video game. It has a concept like a video game, but the film is all computer-generated and has facial recognition to help identify the actors that are in the movie. I first saw this film in theaters by myself because no one wanted to go with me. I went and felt very cerebral when walking out of the film. I actually found it very artsy and very well done. The design and the course of the score was amazing. What is the plot of this film? Well, let's give it to you. Blurring the lines between reality and computer animation, Final Fantasy: The Spirits Within is a first feature-length motion picture that brings vivid photorealism to computer-generated human characters. The thrilling, futuristic action-adventure pits the Earth and its people against the ultimate enemy, mysterious aliens that steal the energy from all living things on the planet. The description doesn't quite do it justice. Let's delve deeper. Here's a few brief facts regarding the film. It's one of the first computer-generated animated motion pictures with photorealistic characters. All the backgrounds are actually hand-painted, which is super cool. Aki Ross was named number 87 on Maxim's magazine Hot 100 list for 2001 and was featured on the cover of the supplemental insert. She's the only non-existent person to date to make that list, which is kind of hilarious. Dr. Aki Ross's hair is only half as dense as the average human crop. However, that still left 60,000 strands to put realistically into motion. When designing the computer graphics, a fifth of the time spent was devoted to these 60,000 hairs. The total production of the time on the film was over 4 years. By the time the final shots were rendered, some of the earlier ones had to be redone because they didn't match anymore. Also, the software used to create them had become more advanced, and hence more detail was possible. Due to the poor performance of the film at the box office, Square Pictures announced its retirement from the film business in October 2001. The studio did, however, go on to produce the short film Final Flight of the Osiris in a similar realistic CGI style of Final Fantasy, which played in theaters before Dreamcatcher, which was in 2003, and was released as the first of a series of short films entitled The Animatrix. Most of you have heard of that. After shooting and initial animation wrapped, completed scenes were fed to Square Pictures' custom and more or less homemade render farm computer network, which consisted of 960 individual Pentium 3 933 megahertz workstations and processed into single frames. During this rendering process, the raw animation had the textures and the extremely fine detail added by the network cluster. Each frame has twice the resolution of a high-definition TV signal and contains 10 megabytes of data. Prior to the film's release, there was a speculation that the photorealistic computer-generated actors would revolutionize movie-making. There were news reports of plans for the digital actress used for Aki Ross to appear in another movie or possibly be included in a live-action production among real actors. The box office failure of the film put those plans on hold. However, a special sequence created for the special edition of the DVD, which opens disc 2, does in fact show Aki and other Final Fantasy characters interacting with real people. Much later, we would see the amazing fake performance of a dead actor in Rogue One, A Star Wars Story by Peter Cushing, who was entirely CGI. The motion capture work by Remington Scott, pioneered for Final Fantasy, led directly to his being hired to create Gollum for the Lord of the Rings trilogy, cementing the use of motion capture in Hollywood. For a series trademark, now this is a series trademark for the video game series, not the movie. Sid, which is spelled C-I-D, is keeping with tradition of characters named Sid in the Final Fantasy series. There is a Sid in the movie, played by Donald Sutherland. In keeping with that tradition, he also possesses an airship. In early storyboards, the character Ryan Whittaker, voiced by Ving Rhames, was equipped with a cybernetic right arm, in what would have been a reference to Final Fantasy VII. The original male lead, which was Matt Dillon, visited Square Animation Studio in Honolulu and saw completed footage of his character, realizing for the first time how photoreal the characters were intended to be, and stormed out of the building yelling that Square was trying to put actors out of business. He was replaced by Alec Baldwin. When the movie was digitally projected, Texas Instruments DLP, it became the first ever to include a genuine 8-channel Sony SDDS soundtrack. The prototype 8-channel soundtracks had been in use by SDDS since 1993, but the one for this movie was considered the first perfect standard for the format. The Psycho wristwatch worn by Aki Ross, known as the Wrist Hollow, which produces the map of New York City, is a digital recreation of the actual Psycho watch made specifically to tie in with the movie. A different design with numerous cosmetic changes was sold publicly. During pre-production, the script went through 50 incarnations. In one such form, there was a small child named Meg, who had a much larger part in the overall story. In the final version of the film, the fifth spirit was drawn from a terminally ill child. This was the only reference to Meg left in the final version. Other characters that didn't make the final cut include a boy named Daniel and a fifth member of the Deep Eyes squad called Robert. The Twin Towers of the World Trade Center did not appear in any of the New York shots except in the concept drawings of the DVD. The Deep Eyes squadron has 4 members, a reference to the Final Fantasy game series where 6 of the 10 games you are limited to 4 people in your team, despite the fact that there's usually more than 5 characters. The serial number 102171 that's found on the side of the black boa is the birth date of one of the artists who designed and textured the ship. Matt McKenzie, who voiced the Major, is the only actor in the film to have also starred in the Final Fantasy game. He would later voice Aaron in Final Fantasy X and its sequel, Final Fantasy X-2. In the earlier version of the script, Sid and Aki were actually grandfather and granddaughter, and Aki's last name was also different. She was originally Aki Shishido, apparently. The relationship and names were changed late enough into production that many of the animators and staff didn't even know of the modification of the script until the film was nearly finished. When talking about Final Fantasy and its digital characters, Tom Hanks had said, "I'm very troubled by it, but it's coming down, man, it's going to happen, and I'm not sure what actors can do about it." During the conference scene where Hein and Sid debate how to kill the Phantom, some of the faces in the audience are modeled on behind-the-scenes personnel. This was the first Final Fantasy not scored by series composer Nobuo Uematsu. The man behind the music of all 10 Final Fantasy games, excluding Final Fantasy Tactics, were composed by Masanori Iwata and Hitoshi Sakimoto. His music is so loved by fans that it's often released on separate CDs by popular demand. Now, the poor box office performance in theaters caused Square Pictures to shut down. 2 years later, it led to the merger of Squaresoft and Enix, which became Square Enix in 2003. 4 years later, in 2005, another Final Fantasy movie would be made called Final Fantasy VII Advent Children, released only directly to DVD and Blu-ray. Before Elliot Goldenthal was brought in to compose the score, the film was temp-tracked from James Horner's score for Titanic. Cues from the piece A Promise Kept was borrowed for the original opening sequence and can be found on the special edition DVD. Now, the film takes place in 2065, which is, of course, future, and costing $137 million, this is the most expensive video game adaptation ever made up to the point, surpassing Lara Croft Tomb Raider, which cost $115 million. It held the record for nearly a decade until surpassed by Prince of Persia, The Sands of Time. After adjusting for inflation, Final Fantasy remains the most expensive, costing $237 million, followed by Prince of Persia, which was $210 million, and Warcraft of $204 million. Now here's something really interesting. Jeff Ventar was about to script a remake of The Lady from Shanghai for Columbia Pictures when an executive asked him to read the script for Final Fantasy. The studio didn't understand the project. They just knew it needed a rewrite and asked Ventar to do what he could in 2 weeks. Ventar read the draft and told them they needed to start over from scratch. They didn't need to hire a 2-week rewriter. He said they needed to hire someone who could stay on the project for 6 months or a year. The studio responded by saying Ventar could have 3 weeks. So he took the job and rewrote the entire script in 3 weeks. What he never imagined was that the script would be translated into Japanese and then retranslated back into English, making the dialogue sound stilted, like a dubbed anime, or that everyone, including the director's secretary, would be writing inexplicable dialogue as the script continued to develop. The end result, of course, did not make for a very strong screenplay. Talking about the project now, Ventar points out that Sakaguchi and his team were truly entering unexplored territory, photoreal human beings. James Cameron himself went out to see the studio in Honolulu, and upon seeing their progress, knew he would never be first. It was the year 2001, Ventar said, and the movie was itself a science fiction. On a sad end note, his passion project remake of The Lady from Shanghai landed Brandon Fraser, who wanted to star with Michael Douglas, and Catherine Zeta-Jones. But at last minute, the John Woo-produced project was scuttled by Amy Pascal, who wanted to focus on teen pictures. Now, James Woods reprised his role of Hades from Hercules in the Kingdom Hearts franchise, which also features characters from the Final Fantasy franchise. Additionally, the Hercules-based worlds in Kingdom Hearts are the only Disney-based world that Final Fantasy characters appeared in. This is the first full CGI film based on the video game franchise, as well as the only one of such until Ratchet & Clank and the Angry Birds movie, which was 15 years later. So let's discuss some of the score by Elliot Goldenthal. Now, with Final Fantasy The Spirits Within, by the time Columbia Pictures feature-length production in 2001, Hironobu Sakaguchi's extremely popular creation of the 9 Final Fantasy video games had already been established. With a futuristic, fantastic vision of Earth in decades to come, as well as the nasty alien forces that come to conquer us as we evolve into energy, the game feature awe-inspiring graphics, as does the film. While technically falling under the anime genre of films, this Final Fantasy production exhibits the best CGI rendering technologies to date, making its animated characters with voices performed by an impressive cast look remarkably realistic. Somewhat surprisingly, the film failed to garner the impressive fiscal success necessary to inspire the assumed cinematic sequels of like-minded technology. Enthusiasts of the concept were hoping to hear the music of Nobuo Uematsu, composer of all the games in the series. The Spirits Within, though, was instead treated to an entirely different sound from avant-garde composer Elliot Goldenthal. The composer's style are radically divergent, as any avid collector of Uematsu's game scores can testify, and debate has persisted throughout the 2000s about the comparative merits of Goldenthal's involvement with the franchise. Since Goldenthal's emergence into film scoring in the early 1990s, the classical composer stood on the fringe of the mainstream, shunning most major projects that didn't involve a dark, mysterious, or terrifying plot. The exceptions, of course, had been his 2 scores for the first Batman franchise, which, along with Alien 3, Interview with the Vampire, gave him enough mainstream name appeal to add credibility to Final Fantasy The Spirits Within. Still, Goldenthal was an anomaly, best appreciated in the totality of his works by a fraction of the film music collecting community. His distance from mainstream popularity at the time was best exemplified in a large late 1990s Vanity Fair photo of top 2 dozen composers of the era, for which most had seen happily conversing with each other, oblivious to the camera. That is, except for Goldenthal, who took the opportunity to give the cameraman the evil eye. His scores aren't much different, often verbose in their unpredictable expressions of dramatic darkness. His experimentation with electronics is often accompanied by the challenges of 20th century avant-garde creativity and 19th century classicalism that mutate into gothic themes and high-pitched strings that typically perform his solemn adagios. More than anyone else in the 90s, Goldenthal is a master of creating unnerving scores, and although such music doesn't always translate into an album, like, for instance, Alien 3 and Sphere, they were very effective in stirring debates among intellectual listeners and, more importantly, scoring audiences. And while Final Fantasy The Spirits Within contains its fair share of creepy and frightening moments, it's entirely different as a breed of film. The fact that the film was an animated project presented Goldenthal with a difficult twist. one that would require him to change his equations to the extent, rather than allowing his work to exist as simply a supplementary atmospheric tool, Goldenthal was presented with the challenge of portraying and extending the emotions that the animated characters feel, since those characters, despite the fantastic CGI rendering, still suffered from a lack of convincing realism for many audiences. To accomplish this emotional depth, Goldenthal was forced to create a more lyrical and melodic score than his norm, something that might have come as a shock to film score collectors at the time. But still an amazing piece of music. Goldenthal recorded Final Fantasy with the massive expansion of the LSO, which is the London Symphony Orchestra, in several of the largest and most impressive English locales available. For cues of large-scale bombast, Goldenthal employed extra brass players and a wide array of percussion experts, and when combined with a full chorus, the total sum of players and singers for this score numbered in the hundreds. This is obviously no run-of-the-mill LA recording. The budget allotted for Goldenthal was very generous, and he used every last bit of it to record one of the most brutally expansive scores heard in recent history. In sheer volume, Goldenthal's music abounds with a mighty force of sound. While the composer may claim that his thematic development is more lyrical and melodic than anything he had ever done, his title theme and softer secondary ideas for the film are still saturated with his gothic, melodramatic style of brooding weight. Instead of creating straightforward major key motifs to signify a hero's theme or a grand vista, Goldenthal continued to handle such cues by simply amplifying his oppressive minor key inclinations to a level of monumental resonance and volume that produces a similar adequate result. Now, to begin discussing these cues, the title theme for Final Fantasy, heard first on the album at the outset of Race to Old New York, a cue not really heard in the film, is a twisted waltz with agonized strings performing over layers of ostinatos that are as turbulent as those of any Goldenthal other score. There's a certain pompous nature to this theme, especially when the brass section takes its helm, which gives it the personality of a treacherous yet gloomy fanfare, an actual fanfare of solitary simplicity is introduced prior to the product in The Spirits Within. Goldenthal employs his bloated brass section and pipe organ to deliberately blast out a theme of more malicious intent. Let's play this cue. A softer theme for both humanity and romance is heard in The Kiss, exploring on the piano the personal element in its most commonly related form. None of these themes in particular are catchy, for their arguably awkward constructs lend them to a complexity that is best appreciated only in the context of their often complicated renderings. It's still truly artistic and very beautiful. So I'd like you to listen to this piece called The Kiss. The majority of the score consists of abrasive action cues. It will likely please listeners who enjoy Goldenthal's two Batman scores, with significant references made back to Batman Forever specifically. These sequences are sometimes scored with the monumental power of the percussion section at the forefront, highlighted by Winged Serpent, which returns to the opening fanfare of gloom over a bed of relentless timpani and snare drum performances. Luckily, absent from the score is the trilling of brass that Goldenthal seems to love, and even his usual high-pitched quivering of strings is limited to a handful of cues. So let's play Winged Serpent. Another unique piece is called Toccata and Dreamscapes, and Goldenthal reverts completely to his Alien 3 style of total disharmony and obnoxious sample mutilation. Now, whether this may sound discordant or not, I really like this piece, so let's go ahead and play it. Thank you. For their novelty at the time, the highlights of Final Fantasy are the cues that gently explore love and remembrance in the softer theme of humanity, culminating in a full ensemble statement in Adiago and Transfiguration. These cues show that Golden Thal can indeed express his own intense styles within the context of a highly romantic performance of a harmonic nature. The project allowed Golden Thal the rare opportunity to expand his theme into a song for the film, which he adapted for Laura Fabian, who is a native of France, to perform. Hearing the pop song translated from Golden Thal's unorthodox chord progressions is an interesting experience, perhaps too awkward compared to the commonly accepted and simplistic James Horner type of song to be successful. The second song is a harder, more irritating rock affair that will probably not interest Golden Thal's collectors. Both songs were set to appear over the film's final end credits. The album is an enhanced CD that concentrated on giving concept fans a preview of the forthcoming Final Fantasy X game. Overall, Final Fantasy is stylistically rooted in Golden Thal's usual morbidly dramatic sensibilities and wild instrumental applications, so it will be jarring for some listeners in its more active moments. The brutality in its tone can be overwhelming, but its thematic development and emotional depth is far beyond anything heard from Golden Thal's outside of Frida. One of the most amazing cues that I found with the score is searching for life forms. It's haunting and enigmatic. It plays with your emotions, and the strings really heighten the tension. It's terrifying in its expectation. The strings are violent and erratic, creating a truly terrifying experience. The choir, though, really are at their best. So listen to this carefully, and I recommend doing it on headphones. Thank you. Another favorite of mine is the Zeus Cannon. The percussion of the drums and the horns really give this cue a full force and embrace the epic scale of the destruction that the villain is trying to do. Let's go ahead and hear the full force of this cue. There are just two more cues that I'd like to discuss in this episode. First is Death of Planet, which gives us a full range of Elliot Goldenthal's mastery of scoring techniques. It's beautiful and haunting and definitely intense. The score far exceeds the wonder of the film and can truly be appreciated on its own. So I want you to enjoy this cue. Sadly, we've come down to another end of Soundtrack Alley. I'd like to thank Alexander Schiebel for composing Soundtrack Alley's theme music. Find his work at xanderscores.com. The last cue that I'll be playing today is Adiago and Transfiguration. There is a song that is sung during the credits that has words, but we'll play the instrumental piece that gives us the full effect of the orchestra. I hope you've enjoyed this episode, and I hope to produce many more over the course of this year. It's just taken me a while to get back in the groove of things. Had some job changes and had life changes, so we're back, and it's good to be back recording behind the mic. So for now, enjoy Adiago and Transfiguration, and until next time, happy listening. Thank you for listening to Soundtrack Alley today. If you're on Apple Podcasts, please take the time to give the show a 5-star rating. Check out my content over at SoundtrackAlley.com, and you'll also find some archived shows over on Cinematic Sound Radio under the title Essential Soundtracks, and also Anime Spectacular, where that is some newer material that's produced. If you have a comment, question, or concern, please email me at soundtrackalley@gmail.com.